WVW Broadcast Network is pleased to present The Chris Gobbett Show. Chris is a national security consultant, speaker, and conservative commentator. As the lead undercover researcher in one of the most successful post-9/11 undercover operations in the United States, Gobbett posed as a Muslim convert and gained access to Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas-backed organization leadership meetings. While undercover, he preserved more than 12,000 pages of evidence and 300 hours of covert audio and video recordings from the Council on American Islamic Relations headquarters. This undercover operation is the feature of Muslim Mafia, a book authored by investigative journalists Paul Sperry and Dave Gobbett, Chris's father. Gobbett has been featured on numerous global media networks, national television shows, and radio programs, including The Sean Hannity Show, Tipping Point with Liz Wheeler, The Savage Nation, Breitbart News Daily, and Louder with Crowder. And now, here is your host, Chris Gobbett.
This is Chris Gobbett coming to you from the WVW Broadcast Network studio, and we have an incredibly important show for you tonight. The American people spoke loudly and clearly in 2016. We wanted to make America great again. We elected Donald J. Trump to be President of the United States of America, and we gave him the House and the Senate as part of a mandate to fulfill his campaign promises. President Trump has been barraged by a 24/7 news cycle that works more like DNC propaganda, fake news, than journalism. President Trump has been opposed by the political establishment on both sides of the aisle. His Make America Great Again agenda is under constant assault. We're witnessing a political warfare campaign against a duly elected president, the likes of which we have never seen. And the more we find out, the more we know, the worse it gets. With that, I want to bring on a very special guest, Rich Higgins. He's an expert on political warfare and the nexus between theological doctrines and information age unconventional warfare. And he spent 20 years combating terrorism. In 2004, Mr. Higgins formed the Department of Defense Irregular Warfare Support Program and served as the organization's first program manager until June 2010. Mr. Higgins has advised the White House, Congress, and foreign governments on strategy, technology, and terrorism-related matters. He was also on the National Security Council under President Trump. Rich, thank you so much for joining us today. We have got a lot to talk about, but let's start with what I think of and consider to be one of the most important documents that was written under President Trump's administration, and that was what's known now as the Higgins Memo, but it was a 2017, it came out in May 2017. It was a political warfare memo where you outlined some of what President Trump was up against. And for people that don't really have an understanding of that memo and haven't read it yet, I highly encourage you to find that memo. You can Google Rich Higgins Memo, political warfare memo, and read it. But for a little bit of background, Rich, walk us through what prompted you to write it and some of the highlights in that memo.
Hey, Chris. Well, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I think that, you know, the simplest way to put it is we hear a lot of talk about the deep state and you know, in my mind, the deep state is simply the institutional government and the power that rests in these government institutions. And I think that, you know, as the American people elected Donald Trump because they had a perhaps intuitive sense that something was wrong inside the, you know, inside the institutional government with the direction that they'd seen the country taken for a number of years where, you know, even when we elected, you know, Republicans, whether they be president or we gave the Senate or the House to them, the country continued this leftward drift, you know, away from a production capitalist model to a more financial capitalist model, you know, watching our industry get hollowed out and moved overseas, the ongoing struggles we have with immigration, the issues with Islamic terrorism. And I think that President Trump distinguished himself from the establishment's candidates, both Republican and Democrat, really at the first Republican debate. Remember where, you know, I think it was Megyn Kelly asked, will you support the candidate, you know, of the party? And I think it was Trump who either didn't, you know, he was the one guy who basically said no, you know, it depends on what the candidate stands for. And, So he created it was a de facto third party candidacy where he hijacked the Republican establishment's vehicle and took that for a ride, right?
Right.
And I think he came in and he was inaugurated in January, but you know, even folks like myself who knew that the institutional resistance would be substantial recognized that, okay, he's going to be the duly elected president. People will, you know, they'll fall in line within reason. Of course, you'll see some of the political gamesmanship that normally goes on. But shortly after the inauguration, and this is the, you know, getting to answer your question, we saw, you know, a systematic media campaign, a systematic campaign of leaks directed against this president where, you know, telephonic transcripts of his conversations with foreign leaders were being leaked, unprecedented in American history. And as more and more facts and more data points began to become available, and as I began my, you know, my stint on the NSC, it became clearer and clearer that this was an orchestrated campaign. And, you know, at the time I didn't know this, what we now know as Operation Crossfire Hurricane, but I was trying from within the institutional government to provide the information to the president and was unable to do so. So working with a couple of other folks, you know, some senior, former FBI senior leaders and current FBI senior leaders, as well as some folks from outside the administration, we collectively put together the memo. Well, bears my name. It has the imprimatur of more than just my own knowledge and observations in it. And I think what we wanted to do was provide for the president and anybody who read the memo a context for A, why he was being opposed so forcefully, B, how that campaign would roll itself out, and C, what the actual, and you see this in the towards the end of the memo, what the actual information campaign was A, structured like, and B, intended to accomplish, which was, you know, isolate the president, empower the institutional government around him to control him, and convince the American people that, you know, at best he is an illegitimate president and perhaps he's working on behalf of a foreign government, thereby delegitimizing him, and most importantly, delegitimizing, demotivating, and attacking the morale of the people who'd elected him in the first place. Because ultimately, President Trump is a manifestation of the movement that created him.
Yes.
And I think that it's that movement that was really the target of this Operation Crossfire Hurricane.
Now, when you wrote the memo, just for people to understand, this is something that you have a background in, political warfare, irregular warfare. You've seen this story play out in other parts of the world. Were you at all surprised to see this happening in the way that it was laid out here in America against President Trump?
I think that I was surprised at, that it was happening. I think at the time, you know, I have to go back 2-3 years now. At the time we were making these observations, you know, there were critical assumptions incorporated into our analysis. We didn't know what we knew now. You know, we hadn't seen the Strzok and Page texts.
Right.
We hadn't seen the Comey memos. This was at the time where Comey was still seen as a legitimate director, right? I mean, right. He had just been fired. And I think what surprised me more than anything else was that it wasn't just a couple of individuals running a media leak campaign. These folks had tasked some of our most sensitive national surveillance capabilities, like FISA, and put them to use against the President of the United States. Not just the candidate. They continued to spy on him and his affiliates, even as he was the President of the United States, and this continued all the way up until the Comey firing. So I think what surprised me at the time was how well orchestrated it was, and then now looking back 2 years hence with more facts, I underestimated the seriousness of the situation. I mean, I, you know, it was serious, and now looking back at it, it was even more serious than I realized. I mean, we've heard in the media lately terms like coup thrown around, and I don't think that's an understatement. I think it was. It was an administrative legal coup attempt, the special counsel being, you know, twofold. First, a rear guard action against some of the things that they had done, but also perhaps had it been successful, the means by which they had hoped to remove the president. Truly a remarkable time in American history, honestly.
Yeah, and I think this is something that, you know, from a conservative standpoint, I really believe that with very few exceptions, conservative media, conservative talk radio, they're emphasizing how important this is. They're talking about the word coup, but it's almost like it's going over people's head. You know, this is real. We have people inside the government and outside through the media and other in other avenues that are actually trying to and did attempt a coup against a current sitting president. And to hear somebody with your background, and you've seen this before, you've seen this played out in other parts of the country, you know you have a background. I don't think, and I don't want to drop names, because many of these people are good people on conservative talk radio and conservative media, but when I listen to it, when I digest it, I am not seeing a sense of urgency. I'm not seeing it on the establishment side of the Republicans. I'm not even seeing it really being portrayed by conservative Republicans out there, that this is real. We're in the middle of something that, if we don't get this right over the next few years, there are real consequences to that. Am I missing something in my assessment of this, that there's not this general sense of urgency that maybe we should have considering the situation?
Well, as somebody who worked for the government, I can tell you that you know, the normal behavior pattern of the government is not to move quickly on anything, right? Okay. I mean, the institution is an enormous aircraft carrier, and it turns slowly and deliberately so as not to, you know, to tip the deck. And I think, you know, what you want to see, and candidly, I'm hopeful that Attorney General Barr is the guy who's going to do this, is you want to see a deliberate and purposeful attempt, not necessarily a hair on fire attempt, but deliberate and purposeful attempt to reinstitute the rule of law. And the thing that really strikes me is, you know, where you have the intelligence community and the Department of Justice are utilizing our most sensitive surveillance capabilities against the president. I mean, had this been a kinetic coup, a military type coup, you know, can you imagine a cadre of generals using our Air Force and fighter planes and tanks to remove the government? That, because of the nature of the means used against the president, i.e. surveillance, telephonic tasking, legal maneuvering, people understate the danger. You know, they underestimate the danger associated with the precedent that these guys are setting. My personal opinion and what I hear from guys inside is that Attorney General Barr is a good man, a solid citizen, and a constitutionalist. And I have confidence that he's going to get us back on track. You know, your other point about the media, on what issue is the media ever, you know, really honest anymore? I mean, I have to be candid with you. I mean, you know, the Fourth Estate is dead in this country. There is no such thing as journalistic integrity. We've seen this going back now 20 years. We've watched this didn't begin in the past 2 years. We've watched the agonizing, slow death of journalism in this country. And it is one of the true tragedies of our time, where reality is constantly bent or subverted to move the American public into narratives that the elites want. I don't know how the Republic stands in this journalistic environment. I have hope that, you know, the media, the social media stuff, but now we see the powers, you know, the powers that control the traditional media now moving to take control inside the social media with shadow banning, yeah, and content removal and so on and so forth. And that's why I'm happy to come on here and talk to you on the show today, because I think this is one of the few platforms where Rich can get the message out.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rich. I think I even did it there, and it's something that I encourage other people not to do. Let's not base our success in the conservative movement, in this movement, to really, President Trump outlined it. He said, make America great again, to conserve the republic. We can't gauge our success based off of CNN, MSNBC, even Fox News. I mean, we just had, in the last few weeks, Judge Jeanine censored. We had Donna Brazile brought on to Fox News. And then we had Paul Ryan added to the board at Fox News. So we can't gauge our success as far as getting our message out based off of any of these traditional media outlets, which is why I feel that it's so important to have platforms like this. But when I talk about our side, conservative media, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about many people on conservative talk radio, which is one of the last places that we can have conversations like this. But it's something that I'd like to talk more about, but there's so much I want to go into. So, Rich, just in a few minutes, you wrote the memo in May 2017. You touched on it. You didn't know at the time about certain aspects of the Mueller investigation. Now that you've seen everything play out since writing the memo and working on the memo with other people, what's your assessment? If somebody were to go watch the show, they go, they're excited, they want to read the memo, they want to get more informed, and then now they say, okay, I've read the memo from May 2017. What would your update to them be?
I think I probably am due to write one. Yeah, to okay. For starters, so I think that's a good prompt.
It's a lot.
I think in a nutshell, I think we could kind of check the block on, you know, yes, we were correct on the subversive aspects of it. Yes, we were correct on the infiltration aspects of it. I think I would add a couple of different points, which is I always centered the conspiracy, if you will, inside of the Bureau. But I think actually now, with the emergence of the role Brennan played with his interagency group, the preliminary targeting of Flynn and the need to remove him so as to continue their campaign against the president, because Flynn wouldn't have allowed it to continue. You know, we found out just in the past few days that Andrew McCabe purposefully went to Mike Pence as the vice president and asked Vice President Pence to intervene on the FBI's behalf as part of the campaign. I think, you know, if I were to write an update to it, the update to it would be that the president has, you know, he has survived the administrative portion of the attempt to remove him. The appointment of Barr is a step in the right direction. And the next 6 months are critical because it's in these 6 months that the president will move to reestablish the rule of law. You know, when I think back to the campaign, I remember, you know, he'd have these lock her up slogans and all this other stuff. But really, the president's Make America Great Again platform was about some core principles. And one of the big ones was the rule of law. Yes. And I think the emergence of the Department of Justice and the Department of Justice's role in this campaign is one of the most troubling aspects of this. I'd like to see a lot of focus. If I were going to steer a special counsel, or I were going to steer the Attorney General to look deeply in a specific area, I would ask him to really focus on Nelly and Bruce Orr and Christopher Steele and their relationships with Russian intelligence. Nelly Orr is she's kind of she's like the shadow in behind a lot of this. You know, she touches the Justice Department, she touches the CIA, she touches Fusion GPS. She's, you know, spent significant amount of time with the blessing of the Soviet Union in the former USSR in 1989. And then the thing that really jumps out at me about Nelly Orr is she's communicating with a ham radio. Which, you know, for people that aren't familiar with tradecraft, that jumps out at you as in the Cold War, they used to use a system called one-way voice link, where you would transmit in code on ham radio, you're never receiving anything. And so, if I were steering things today, I'd really focus in on her and then build out the onion, if you will, with them at the center of it, not per se the leaders of the institutions of which they had influence. The scale of the conspiracy, I don't think, is as large as the American public might imagine. I think in total, it's probably less than 50 to 100 people that really need to be, you know, identified. And I'm glad to see, and I haven't been briefed or read into any of the classified work that they're doing, but I know that Devin Nunez has begun dropping criminal referrals over to the Justice Department. That's a key point that the American public needs to focus upon right now, because how the Justice Department reacts to those criminal referrals will tell us whether or not we're going to bring back any semblance of the rule of law.
Well, and you touched on something. For those of you that are watching WVWTV.com, in a few episodes, watch out for it. I'm going to be having a conversation with Diana West, who just came out with the book, The Red Thread, and we are actually going to dive into Bruce and Nelly, or what Rich was, the people Rich was just referring to. So tune into that when we release that. So speaking of The Red Thread, let's move into a little bit. The Red Thread is a book about the ideological drivers, the Marxist drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy that Diana West just authored. She's an investigative journalist. She wrote a great book called American Betrayal. And you had a great, there's a great panel that you were on with Frank Gaffney from Center for Security Policy, and Center for Security Policy Press released that book, The Red Thread. Let's talk about those ideological drivers that are involved in the anti-Trump conspiracy. Dialectical materialism. You know, for the average person, when I bring that up, Rich, and I do a lot of public speaking around the country. I talk to groups. I think last month it was over a dozen groups or, around the country in about five different states. And they know something's wrong. Their gut tells them that something's wrong. They've been watching this play out over the last few years. But articulating and putting everything in context because of all the information that's out there, it's hard for the average person. At the core of what's driving this anti-Trump conspiracy is this idea of dialectical materialism. And for the average person watching this, how would you break that down for them to help them understand that?
Well, I think the first I'm going to answer that question, I want to talk about it in larger context.
Okay.
The term itself refers to the Marxist Hegelian, baseline thinking. But for the average person, I think the simplest way to describe it is Hegel was a German, political scientist, philosopher, writer, and I think Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, introduced this concept of the dialectic. And the dialectic sounds like a fancy buzzword, but it's really very simple. If you have an idea on one hand, and somebody else has an opposing idea on the other hand, those two ideas come together, create synthesis, and then you have the left's buzzword, progress, right? And through that synthesis, we have progress. Now, here's the problem with this dialectic term. When you have a truth on this side, okay, that you're endowed by Creator with certain inalienable rights, like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, what is the opposite of that? It's some form of untruth. So you move to a point of what? Lesser truth? Okay? And this is the danger of the dialectic, is that when you're operating on fundamental truths, the dialectic is a negating factor. It constantly diminishes those truths. And so dialectic materialism, so Hegel comes up with the dialectic. Dialectic materialism is simply Marx's application of the dialectic in terms of the economy. And he really saw things in terms of class structure and economic modalities, seeking to overturn the political power structures, as it were. The dangers that we face today regarding this, these core ideologies emanate primarily from our elites, right? And during the Cold War, we have to understand, from 1940, we can debate on when the Cold War started. I'll say 1951, okay?
Okay.
From 1951 until 1991, in those 40 years, the United States was involved in a 40-year war, right? And that 40-year war against this, the Soviet Union, had all sorts of ideological components to it, various, branches and sequels in this ongoing global campaign with communism. But the thing that we never did at the end of the war was, post-Soviet Union, there were never Nuremberg trials for the Soviet Union, right? Those communists drifted back into society. And if you look at the Russia of today, it's led by a former KGB officer. Right. And I think what President Trump detected, and I think what the MAGA movement about was, we saw going back into the 50s and 60s a concerted massive effort on the part of the Soviet Union to influence the United States. And they targeted specific groups here, student and youth groups, labor groups, media, I bang on my table with that one, media, and elites, right? The universities. And all of those institutions, you know, and there are exceptions, I'm not saying every single one, but all of those institutions as a collective now really push the left's agenda. And when I say the left, I'm talking about the dialectic materialist agenda. And this manifests itself in schools where, you know, ideas from, you know, for example, the transgender movement, ideas that 40, 30 years ago would have been scoffed at by our grandfathers and our fathers' generation are now shoved down the throats of 7, 8, 9-year-old children in public schools in America. And so where these ideas really are planted is they're deep inside American culture now, because what's happened is the Soviet Union was so effective with their influence campaigns that they moved what would be considered traditional America to the left. So this entire drift left, where there's a, and if you recall in the memo, I specifically linked to a segment of an interview with Yuri Bezmenov, yeah, ran Soviet influence operations. And the purpose for doing that was to show there is an ideological component to this that exists in a way that, you know, most people don't conceptualize warfare, you know, in terms of the ideas being propagated to their children. But it is a form of warfare. And so what I worry about today is, you know, our national security institutions have largely dropped their capacity to conduct this form of ideological warfare. And as a matter of fact, it's so poor right now that they're incapable of even recognizing it. And lo and behold, Diana West has now written this book, The Red Thread. And I'm happy to say that she asked me to do a peer review on it before she published it. And she'll tell you herself that it is a preliminary, you know, it is the beginnings of a wider investigation that needs to take place. But just a couple of short little excerpts, you know, and ideas to kind of throw at the audience. Number one is John Brennan is admitted communist. Okay, he admitted he was a communist in his interview to join the CIA, yet he still joined the CIA. Christopher Steele, also known as an admitted socialist while he was at Oxford. Nellie Orr, you know, studied inside the Soviet Union, you know, fluent in Russian, lots of ties that I'll leave those hanging. That's a part of the book that's really worth reading based on, you know, and I said earlier, Nellie's central to this whole thing, and she's not a central character in the media's discussions of it. The things that jumped out at me were James Comey also admits in an interview with the New York Magazine to having been a communist. And then we have the most communist of all, right? Barack Obama, who ran on the platform of being a community organizer. And anybody who's ever read Saul Alinsky recognized back in 2007, 2008, when he was running for office, he was saying he was a community organizer. Well, that's Saul Alinsky's term. It's a communist community organizer, right, from his book Rules for Radicals. And so as people start digging into this, they're going to find an amazing, for me anyways, it was an enlightening experience, because it showed that there was, and the reason they were so aggressive about this is that as President Trump sought to return America to itself, you know, bring America back to it, back to its sense of self, he was a tremendous threat to them, yeah, and a tremendous threat to the power structures they had laid out in place over the past 30 or 40 years. And President Trump's natural gift is his ability to shatter their narrative, and the narrative of political correctness that they've used to control all of our public discussion and debate for the past 30 years.
Well, and speaking of controlling our discussion and debate, whether it's throughout the national security apparatus or even just the general public, try bringing up the term cultural Marxism, international socialism, scientific socialism, dialectical materialism. Nothing. Falls on dead ears, for the most part. And from my perspective, that's a direct result of an information campaign that's been going on for decades. You can't defeat an enemy that you do not understand and you do not define. And my hope, my prayer, well, it's why I do what I do. I know it's a big reason of why you do what you do, is that we can get the right people, and then the American people, the people that voted for President Trump, the people that want to make America great again, to understand that we have real threats, real ideologies that whose sole purpose is destruction. You know, Bernie Sanders said something interesting just in the last few days. He said that what was radical 5 years ago is mainstream today. And then he went on to call President Trump a racist, xenophobic, homophobic, sexist. And all in one sentence. He got them all in there within a few moments. This is real, and it feels to me like, looking at this from 30,000 feet up, that we've got that certain movements are coming to a head right now, and we as American people have to get a movement going to reclaim our country. It's a real possibility that we lose this republic. Any thoughts on what I just said there, and anything you want to add to that?
I think that, you know, the danger in speaking the truth too forcefully is that, you know, it falls on ears that kind of see you as hyperbolic. I think the reality is that we do and have had two movements operating inside the United States since, really, I think, the Tea Party, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to the Tea Party movement, the left was rolling over us. They were unchallenged. They made tremendous strides, from the 1960s up until 2009, 2010, whatever time the Tea Party really began. And I think that the movement that, you know, put President Trump in office is still alive and well. I would argue that it's presently leaderless in a way. The duties of being the president and then the political comings and goings of being in office have really kind of taken the president himself out of that leadership role. I think at the same time, the American public is well and aware, that being the folks who elected the president is well and aware that something is afoul right now. Right. If there's one real blessing of President Trump's election, it is that he's forced their hand, right? And in so doing, he's made what was previously seen as, you're McCarthyite, or you're a conspiracy theorist. Now people can see it laid out in front of them if they just take the time to look. Where this goes, we're approaching a crossroads. I've used that term in the past. Is we're approaching a crossroads where we're either going to bring back the rule of law, get the immigration thing under control, and recognize that we have an emergent, new power to challenge us on the global scene, perhaps in the form of communist China, or we're going to go the way of Europe and the long, slow, whimpering death, which is, it's almost tragic to sit back and watch and to think that could be us in 30 or 40 years. Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question like the way you wanted me to.
No, I mean, it's a good discussion point, and I really, there's no right or wrong on any of this. I mean, in many ways, we've seen this play out, and yet we've never seen anything like this play out. You know, we've seen certain events transpire over the last 100 years around the world play out with similar movements, but this is all new to everybody. Let's look with the, we have about 15 minutes left here. Let's look for, we've got a few things that have happened, and I want, a lot of people are going to be asking me. I think you're closer to what's going on with all of this, so I'd like people to know, what do you think in a couple of minutes of the recent move with the Department of Homeland Security director resigning, Secret Service director moving on? What do you see with anything big that we need to be paying attention to here, or is this just President Trump kind of moving the pieces around to get his agenda pushed a little bit more?
I think that, first off, I don't think Kirstjen Nielsen should ever have been President Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security. So, okay. He's cleaning house from what Steve Bannon called in his interview on 60 Minutes. I think he termed it the original sin of the administration, right? Which was thinking that he could depend upon the Republican establishment to help him put together his administration. I always found it odd that having been at the convention, spoken there on the president's behalf, and the people that I was there with speaking as a surrogate for the president, of the maybe 80 of us who were there, the only guy who I know of who's actually in the administration is now John Bolton. And I think the president is now moving to perhaps, we'll see, remains to be seen, bring in people who are actually loyal to his agenda. Yeah. You know, we'll know he's doing that because there will be a tremendous outcry in the media, right? So if the media is kicking and screaming, the president's probably doing something right.
Yeah.
In terms of the Secret Service guy leaving, I think, I don't know if you recall, but the Secret Service has had several issues with perimeter control at the White House. Mm-hmm. And then now this apparent incident at Mar-a-Lago. And I think there has to be in an institution with a responsibility as serious as his, there has to be leadership accountability. And this was part of a pattern over the past couple of years. And I think that probably is related to that.
Well, and now, thank you for that. As we move closer to 2020, and it sounds crazy. I mean, we're in what, April of 2019, and yet we are already talking about 2020. There's well over a dozen candidates on the DNC side. Many of these people are signing on to this Green New Deal, this progressive movement. Is there anybody on the DNC side of things that isn't part of or pushing a progressive narrative, whether they're more so wittingly or unwittingly? Is there anybody on the left side of the aisle that you've seen that isn't part of a progressive Marxist movement, whether they realize it or not?
I have not studied the candidates yet, so I'll refrain from naming names and like that. I can tell you that in sitting back and watching the DNC and the Democrats in general devolve, it is a devolution, right? They're devolving, melting into this. I come from a family of Kennedy Democrats. I mean, Boston, Irish, the whole thing, right? And I don't recognize the Democrat Party today from even that, it's become a socialist come Marxist party. Yeah. And they seem to be out Marxisting one another right now. I think it's, but here's the thing, and this is really important for the audience to understand. Do not underestimate them. Do not underestimate those who have been indoctrinated's willingness to receive what these guys are offering. Do not make the same mistake that Hillary Clinton made in 2016 and take for granted that these people will be easily defeated. That is an enormous mistake. As they've grown the dependents amongst the people, and you now have the bread and circus, if you will, on the left, where hard work and the production capitalist model that President Trump ran upon, which is as an individual you produce things, you create you create through your own work, and then you should profit from that work. Children today in the United States are not necessarily taught that, certainly not through public schools. And we fail to recognize that at our own peril. I mean, they're telecasting to you what their thinking is. I mean, they want 16-year-olds voting, right? They want automatic registration to vote. They want all, because they want to get as many people as possible who are dependent upon the government in to vote, because they know that they'll vote in support of the state. And that's really what it comes down to at the end of the day. Do you vote in support of the state on the left, where they will control everything, or do you vote on behalf of the individual? The greatest concern I have is that the Republican establishment will resist the need to clearly draw these lines. And they need to be big, bright red lines that are argued on constitutional and American principles. Really, I would argue American principles, those ideas espoused in the Declaration. And then, calling an old Marxist like Bernie Sanders, where he was hanging out in Moscow in 1983 and literally took his honeymoon there. We laugh at that,
it's dead serious. I mean, I can only sometimes just, what else can you do? It's serious. Yeah.
Look, I mean, Bernie is one of those guys that, Americans look back and we say, you know, how did Vladimir Lenin do what he did? You know, how did Trotsky get away with what he got away with? We fail to sometimes remember that, you know, a lot of these ideas were born not in, you know, some distant Stalingrad. They were born in New York City. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, Lenin left from New York City. He's like an Upper East Side guy, right? I mean, he went there. They're popular. They're cool. They're cool until you challenge their authority. And then they turn the power of the state against you. And what scares me is somebody who's worked on the terrorism issue for so long, particularly fact-based analysis of the Islamic threat, is we already see a lot of the mechanisms of that totalitarian being put in place, you know, where you have statutory and regulatory reform take place and they create things like the Department of Homeland Security. And then you see the Muslim Brotherhood helping write the regulations and the laws associated with it. And then you see this countering violent extremism program take place, which is two really distinct things. On the one hand, it's a counterintelligence program to take down folks like us who want to be factual in our analysis. On the other hand, it's a legal paradigm that defines not the Muslim Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda or Islamic State as the terrorists, but it defines us, constitutional defending, you know, Americans. You know, and if you go and you read the CVE, you see that as, I guess what you'd call it says anybody who will use violence to defend, you know, to defend their beliefs. Well, you know, as a former soldier, I took an oath to use violence to defend my beliefs. So, you know, and then you see DHS, the first thing they do is they name veterans as that threat. Here's where I'm going with this, to bring it back to Bernie. Bernie seems like the lovable old man. But, and that may be the case, he might be the nicest guy in the world. But the reality about what he believes in always leads to despair, totalitarianism, and you know, a state of hostile dependency. You know, the abuser's state of hostile dependency, where the state rules everything. And, you know, he won't be around to see the outcome, right? So he doesn't really care anymore. Now, this is a guy, along with, you know, other folks on the left, like Swalwell and others, that when I see them on TV, these guys are central casting from the Soviet Union circa 1972, right? And, you know, the American public just sits there and says, well, you know, I like some of what these guys are saying, but something's off. When you watch folks like Swalwell or Adam Schiff, or Bernie Sanders, or Kamala Harris, there's something off about them. And you know, I think instinctually, most Americans recognize something that's un-American, right? That's something that's un-American at its core. We may not be able to articulate it per se. It's the inverse of what we see overseas. As somebody who's been overseas a bunch of times, there are Americans in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, right? They're Americans because they believe in the American idea. While they don't exist inside an American government, and certainly not the United States government, they believe in the American idea. And we need to get back to that understanding. So when you see these politicians on TV and they're espousing all these, you know, if what they're arguing for creates a bigger government, a more powerful government, a more intrusive government, you have to question yourself, what is the end state here? And I think that's really what it gets down to, is that thinking ahead. Somebody asked me this about, you know, our immigration policies. And while today we may not suffer under, don't take me the wrong way here, you know, you've got the families who've lost loved ones due to illegal immigrants and so on and so forth. But over time, the cultural erosion that's going to take place and the societal norming that's going to take place, because we're doing such a poor job of even integrating and assimilating the immigrants that we are taking in, it's the future generations and our posterity that are going to suffer. And so as we kind of meander through the issues at hand, I think the president is right in that we need to return to our core essence. And I think when he says America first, that's really what he's talking about. is understanding what America is. And he's invoking first principles, right? It's like Socrates, know thyself. And from that, we can move forward again.
Yeah, and you brought up something that, you know, we have to always remember when we're talking about Marxism. We're talking about ideologies, whether it was under Lenin, Stalin, or Mao, and others that killed tens of millions of people. And we've got people right now that are espousing those same ideologies. And what's really alarming and should be alarming is this throwing around of labels, fascist. You know, our president gets called a fascist, and thereby his supporters are being called a fascist by people on the left. This is really dangerous, because that's a call to, when you get power, you destroy fascism. And, you know, we just saw something. Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, just came out with a book warning, and the title is Fascism. We only have a couple minutes left, Rich, but first off, would you comment on the whole labeling of people that support President Trump as fascist? And then just a 1 or 2 minutes on the average person that's watching this and they want to get involved and they want to do something. I would argue that our focus should always be at the local level. But as we wrap up here, you know, what final thoughts do you have on fascism, that labeling, and then what people can do at the local level?
Well, I think that the labeling is a classic tactic in any, you know, in any power struggle, right? Where you define your adversary as evil, and in defining him or her as evil, they're thereby, you know, able to be removed, you know, by whatever means necessary.
Right.
And you mentioned about Stalin and Mao, et cetera, killing millions and millions of people, you know, on behalf of these ideologies. It's really important. They didn't kill millions and millions of people all over the world. They killed millions and millions of their own people.
Yes.
Anybody internally who opposed them was systematically eliminated. Mao, tens of millions. Stalin, tens of millions. You know, purposely starving people, controlling their access to food, controlling their access to health care. Sound familiar?
Right.
This is a tried and true thing. You know, going back to your labeling question, I'm struck by in 1953, Bella Dodd gave some testimony, and I don't know if you've seen it. I know you're working through that paper I sent you. Bella Dodd gave testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they asked her, you know, now this is a woman who admitted to being part of the Comintern, admitting to help put, homosexuals into the Catholic Church, to help subvert the church, and she in testimony, they asked her, you know, what do the communists do? And she says, well, they label you a racist, a fascist, or worse, an America firster, right? So these were the pejorative terms in 1953.
Right.
So there's nothing new here under the sun. What's different, and this is what President Trump was elected to, what's different is 1953 America had a better sense of itself, of its role in the world, and of the nature of its adversaries, as opposed to today, where we are just awash in a multiculturalist, multilingual haze, where to be American is, you know, it's defined differently by different people. You know, simple things like my children aren't taught civics or civics as I understood them when they were young children. You know, where I actually have a daughter who's in third grade, tells me that three or four of the kids in her class refuse to say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, simple things like that, which would have been absolutely not tolerated when I was a student back in the 70s, right?
It's
I guess, as I look at the entire totality of events, there are two tectonic plates coming in opposite to one another. You have the revolutionary movement that is represented by the Democrats, right? The revolutionary ideas that Bernie says are now mainstream. And you have, in effect, a counter-revolutionary movement, which is the Make America Great Again, returning America to herself. And those two tectonic plates are colliding. And we're seeing some of that play out, you know, in the government institutions themselves.
Yeah, well, I've been encouraging people. Obviously, part of the other side wants people to feel demoralized, even though we're the majority. I mean, we have to constantly remind ourselves that President Trump won because the people turned out to the polls. We're still the majority. There's a lot of hope. We need to get, from my perspective, what I've seen on the ground is we need to get more involved at the local level, whether it's in city councils, whether it's in library boards, school boards, zoning commissions, mayor's office, chiefs of police, sheriffs, and our churches. Getting more involved so that those institutions represent us as the majority. Because oftentimes what I'll see is I'll go to some of the most conservative areas in the country, and if there's 10 liberals in the entire city, they're all on city council. And that's just got to change. As we wrap it up here, Rich, any you know, 30 seconds to a minute about how people can get more involved at the local level and what's really important, because people feel demoralized when they can't fix necessarily what's going on in Washington, D.C. It's much easier to affect what's going on locally.
I think the number one thing that everybody can do is to educate their children and grandchildren. You start at the family unit, right? And that move away from this. Again, whenever you're in these arguments, you're in the dialectic. Move away to just speaking truths by just, you know, throw down a couple of quotes from history if you have to. Become involved in your community. That doesn't even necessarily mean in a formal way, like a city council or something. It can be as simple as attending the meeting, you know, speaking up on issues that you're concerned about. And sometimes that involves just you showing up. Right. And I think that the last thing is, and I think the thing I think is probably most important is, get back to core Americana. You know, that means faith, that means family, and that means rule of law, and do it in your own life and be an example to those around you. Most of the people who are brought into the left are done so in a form of indoctrination that begins when they're small children, that people who are critical thinking enough are able to break out from after they're about 17, 18 years old. You know, work with your children. You know, Justice Thomas said to me once, he goes, "This is, you have to treat your children like you're sending them out on the road and you're the car wash." Right. So as they come back from their Marxist experience, you have to basically wash that off of them. And I thought that was kind of funny. But again, it all goes back to state and local, family. I'm not advocating for collective action. I don't think that's the right answer, is to become like the left. No, that's not the right answer. The right answer is to become a participant, become a citizen. Don't sit at home on your computer and expect things to change. It doesn't work that way.
Oh, and you nailed it. You know, I'm always arguing that a face-to-face interaction is much more valuable than thousands of likes on Facebook and retweets on Twitter. Rich, thank you so much. I know you're incredibly busy. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. It really means the world to me and the people that are watching. This is important. It matters. And I just want to thank you again for coming out and speaking to us today.
Chris, my pleasure. You have a good one.
Thank you. You too, Rich.
Take care.
All right. Well, we've what an incredible interview and experience. Rich Higgins has worked so hard to protect this republic. We are all in this together. We will be bringing you more shows that will outline what we can do at the local level to get more involved. Thank you for tuning in to WVW-TV. This is Chris Gobbets with WVW Broadcast Network, and we will see you again soon. Take care.
Mm-hmm.